from KQED.
It started as a kind of online neighborhood watch, but that changed when some neighbors felt targeted because of their race. It's So Well Spoken from KQED News. I'm Joshua Johnson. In this hour, we take a rare look inside an ongoing racial conflict with the people involved. They're residents in the Oakland Hills using social media to keep their streets safe. But some of the posts may have revealed unspoken prejudices about just what a suspicious person looks like. How are these neighbors airing their differences and finding solutions? They'll tell you, and we'll take your questions and thoughts as we explore how social media helps us come together and sometimes break apart. So Well Spoken is just ahead after the headlines from NPR and KQED News. From KQED News, it's So Well Spoken. I'm Joshua Johnson in San Francisco. The poet Carl Sandburg once said, "Love your neighbor as yourself, but don't take down your fence." That neighborly tension is at the heart of today's program, a conflict involving race, public safety, and social media. It's happening among residents in the Oakland Hills using Yahoo groups, message boards, and websites like Nextdoor.com as a kind of neighborhood watch. But some residents say a lot of the posts about suspicious characters end up targeting people of color, including some of the neighbors.
Black male hoodie walking by, be careful. Black male making a U-turn, it seems suspicious, be on the lookout for this car.
Shakira Porter lives in Oakland's Diamond District. Porter says it reminds her of the kinds of prejudices some folks still have about people of color, prejudices that are rarely spoken but often felt.
You know, the times that I've been profiled, I've been doing very normal things. And so what that message to me says, it just doesn't matter what I'm doing, that I'm a threat. And so this way I have to really contort and dance and be less threatening in the world is exhausting, you know. And then the internalized racism that then, you know, becomes lodged in me, then I have to work at dislodging that. It's a lot of work being a person of color who has to continually prove that they're safe, continually prove that they're okay and that they deserve to be there.
Every major social network forbids racial profiling and discriminatory posts. How can these residents remain vigilant against crime without playing into stereotypes? In this hour of So Well Spoken, we'll hear from some of those neighbors and search for insights and ideas, especially from you, on finding understanding and making peace. Here with us for the hour is Oakland resident Hugh Bartlett. He is one of Ms. Porter's neighbors, and he is a co-moderator of his neighborhood's Next Door group. Hugh, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joshua.
And Audrey Esquivel is a member of Neighbors for Racial Justice, a group that formed 2 years ago in response to troubling neighborhood posts on social networks around Oakland. Audrey, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Joshua.
By the way, for those of you who are listening so you can visualize who's around the table, Ms. Esquivel identifies as a multiracial black woman, and Mr. Bartlett is a white male. Audrey Esquivel, let me start with you. You live in the Glenview neighborhood. Tell us how these posts have affected you personally. Is this just online sniping, or does it actually spill over into affecting real life?
It absolutely affects my real life. I used to walk to our neighborhood Safeway, and I find that I drive to the grocery store now because there's been so many reports of high alert crime reports that go out on the Glen Friends listserv that describe my physical appearance. So
this
I'm
is
less,
a Yahoo group, by the way.
This is a Yahoo group that is just for neighbors that live in my neighborhood. And there are several times that I've said I've seen something on the listserv and it could be describing me, just going about my daily routine, as Shakira said.
So you feel more comfortable going in your car, feeling a little more insulated than being out on the street and having someone look at you funny and presume something about you.
Exactly.
Hugh Bartlett, your responsibility in this Next Door forum that we talked about is to help keep order, make sure the posts are useful, keep them appropriate. Talk about what your thought process has been like with regards to some of these posts about race. How do you decide which ones to keep and which ones to drop?
Well, first of all, I'm a unpaid volunteer and I work full time, so I'm not monitoring the site all the time. And fortunately, we have a very strong Neighbors for Racial Justice group in our neighborhood who do monitor the site. and often comment on a thread when they see profiling happen.
So when you see a post for yourself, absent somebody else's comments, how do you know where the line is? How do you think it through?
Well, there's two aspects to it. It's the description of the person and description of the activity, the suspicious behavior. And the guidelines that Nextdoor has set up for discriminatory profiling are to focus on the behavior rather than the individual and particularly the individual's race.
Meaning that if it's just, you know, I saw a suspicious black guy, that's not good enough. If you don't describe what that person was doing, then that's not information you can use.
Precisely. But then there's all different colors of or ways of interpreting behavior. And I'm sure that a person of color is seen as more suspicious, wherein a person who is white isn't suspicious doing the same thing.
Hugh, and a number of the residents, and part of the controversy behind this is that some of the residents have accused you of trying to censor some of these conversations about these issues on the Nextdoor forum, that they claim you left up some of the posts that they considered profiling and took down some that were trying to drive the dialogue forward. There was a debate as to whether you should be the moderator at all. What do you make of all this conflict, these accusations?
I don't think it's true. I've taken down very few posts. I take down posts for people who are using the site commercially. That's against the guidelines. I try to enforce the guidelines uniformly. There have been only a couple instances where I took down a couple of posts that I felt were against the guidelines.
Audrey, since this is a conversation about, in a sense, racial profiling online, help us draw that distinction of how we determine what is racial profiling. Where do we draw the line between legitimate, useful information about what may well be someone perpetrating criminal activity in town and profiling? Where does that line exist and when do we cross it?
In my opinion, the crime alerts that come across on the email groups, the ones that start by describing a suspicious behavior and then lead into a physical description of the person, seem to go over much better and they are less likely to be perceived as profiling. In my opinion, the alerts that we see that just say brown-skinned woman walking down the street slowly by my house, where's the crime in that? Right?
That could be you, basically.
Right. I'm just having a stroll to the store. But then if there is a private patrol or OPD happens to be in the neighborhood and they've been made aware of this, you know, be on the lookout for my phenotype, then that's when the profiling would occur.
Hugh Bartlett, you had talked about this as well. Does this definition jive with what you see as well, or is there a little more to it than that?
That's pretty accurate. There is a Nextdoor guideline about profiling that essentially says the same thing, focus on the activity first.
Now, as we talk about this controversy, I want to hear from you listening in. How have you dealt with racial conflicts on social media? Maybe it was something involving your neighbors or not, but have you dealt with this? Have you found ways to resolve this or at least to deal with this? If so, give us a call. Here's the number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is sowellspoken@kqed.org. You can tweet us with the hashtag KQEDspoken or post to the KQED News Facebook page. Also with us for the hour to help make sense of all this is UC Berkeley psychology professor Rodolfo Mendoza-Denton. His work focuses on intergroup relations, stigma, and prejudice. Professor Mendoza-Denton, welcome to So Well Spoken.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this situation in Oakland is not unique. We got a tweet from Adriana in Long Beach who alerted us to a Washington Post article about similar cases in New York and Washington, D.C. There are apps like Sketch Factor, Ghetto Tracker. There's one in Washington's Georgetown district called Operation GroupMe where people can take pictures of suspicious characters, and those characters always tend to be people of color. What is going on here? Is there something underlying all of this that's a common bond to these situations?
I do think that there is a certain level of depersonalization that occurs in online media and in the digital world more generally. It's a little bit like what happens with road rage or when people act out of character to what they themselves feel is their own behavior in cars, for example, where there's a barrier. And, you know, however minimal that barrier is, a car, a window, it does put literal physical barriers and distance between yourself and the other human being next to you. Digital media really expands that. And at the same time that it breaks down the fences that you were talking about earlier, it also makes the people on the other side seem less like human beings. And at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about here. There is a little bit of an irony in the sense that, you know, we're talking about the Glenn Friends listserv or the Next Door, you know, and that reminds us, of course, of Neighbors, that there's this neighborly aspect, and yet it can be conducted entirely without any human contact at all. And if we've learned anything about positive intergroup relations, is that human contact, that personalization, really needs to happen for positive intergroup relations to occur. When you have things like Ghetto Tracker, which I didn't know about, it immediately does exactly what the recommendations of not profiling are, which is it puts the association of blackness first.
Right. And it creates this barrier that allows you to view people as this kind of a caricature of themselves rather than as an actual flesh and blood person.
Well, it puts the category membership first before the individual. And I think what we're all talking about here is individuating information, not only for potential suspicious activity, but also for your own neighbors.
I think also, it's easy for some folks to look at this situation, and this is what I do not want to have happen. I think it's easy to look at this situation and see the white people as the antagonist and the people of color as the protagonist. You know, Hugh is automatically the bad guy because he's the white guy, and Audrey is automatically the hero of the story because she's the woman of color. And that's too simplistic. There's more to it, isn't there? There can be emotional damage on both sides. There can be accountability on both sides, and not necessarily with any malice aforethought, right?
I think that's absolutely true. And I, you know, let me first acknowledge that the very presence of Mr. Bartlett here today to discuss these issues is a huge step forward in creating that sense of neighborhood and community, all past behavior aside. So we do have to be forgiving and we do have to be compassionate, but there is, you're absolutely right, a sense in which it's an us versus them, and the category memberships go both ways. One thing that is true, though, is that oftentimes when these conflicts arise, majority group members actually want to stay away from getting into the fray. And so oftentimes what you will see is that someone who might be, for example, a strong supporter of Neighbors for Racial Justice will not come forward and express their support because they don't want to be involved. And I think that needs to happen a little bit more.
Actually, that dovetails into something we're going to get into a little bit later in the hour, but we're up against a break. We're going to keep talking about this on the other side. We'll keep digging into this controversy with Professor Rodolfo Mendoza-Denton, Hugh Bartlett, and Audrey Esquivel. Also, we'll hear from the local reporter who broke this story, and from the CEO of Nextdoor, and we'll dive in on the phones with you and your questions and your insights and your stories. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to So Well Spoken from KQED News. It's So Well Spoken. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about race and social media through the lens of a neighborhood conflict in the Oakland Hills with residents Audrey Esquivel and Hugh Bartlett, and with UC Berkeley psychology professor Rodolfo Mendoza-Denton. Hugh Bartlett, you wanted to respond to something the professor said before the break.
Thank you, Joshua. I wanted to respond on the concept of depersonalization and how I think Nextdoor addresses that. I think that versus the listservs where you don't know who you're talking to all the time, that on Nextdoor you're assured that they're living in the area, that they're a resident, they're verified as a resident, and that they're using their real name. And they also have the opportunity anyway to put a profile picture up there so that you get to know your neighbors face to face. And I think that adds a little personal connection and neighbors knowing neighbors.
Yeah, to Hugh's point, you know, I signed up for Nextdoor, and part of like researching the story because I had not used it before. And what they do is you put in your address, they find your name, and then you have to do a verification step like the last four digits of your social, or they send a code to your phone and then you send it back, as opposed to just being on a on a Yahoo group, and then who knows who all is on there. Audrey Esquivel, go ahead, Audrey.
I just wanted to respond quickly. One of the things that we do have on the Glenn Friends listserv is that every email is required to be signed with your name and your sort of your block. So, for example, I would say Audrion, my street name. So just so we know where we are in proximity to each other as well.
But how much does that idea of depersonalization that the professor brought up, how much does that ring true to you in terms of what you've encountered?
I would say very much so. I think that if we all were, you know, familiar with each other on a face-to-face level, that absolutely would speak to, you know, decreasing these types of just sort of broad, vague descriptions.
Glad to see people chiming in on the phones. Please feel free to keep calling in, 866-733-6786. We'll open the phones in just a minute, but first, let's hear briefly from the reporter who put this story out there. Sam Levin wrote the story, Racial Profiling via Nextdoor.com for the East Bay Express. Sam, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you've talked to the Oakland Police Department about where the line is between racial profiling and usable information. Does it sound kind of like what we've discussed here so far, or is their definition a little bit different?
It does. I mean, Oakland Police do not want to get calls about baseless accusations or about suspicious activity that's not actually suspicious. So they do encourage you, just like Audrey was talking about, to really focus on behaviors. So if, you know, people are seeing something suspicious in their neighborhood, it really has to reflect an actual criminal activity that's in progress. They don't want to get a call about a suspicious person who just looks suspicious because of, you know, their appearance or someone's own kind of unconscious racial bias kind of impacting them. So, you know, when I talked to police for the story, one of the things they said is a good way to sort of check your own potential bias is to ask yourself if that person that you are suspecting of suspicious activity were of a different race, would you consider that activity suspicious? So on Nextdoor, if you see people reporting someone as suspicious for simply walking down the street or driving slowly, you can ask yourself, if that person were white, would I be worried? And would I post about it or potentially call the police on that individual?
And as I understand it, OPD has gotten a fair amount of information that they've had to throw back and say, I can't do anything with this. Please stop posting this.
Yeah, I mean, they get frustrated with that. And police across the country, you know, there's been stories about this, you know, get frustrated when they get calls about activity that is really not suspicious and there's nothing they can do about it. But in general, they do have to, you know, respond to a call for service. And, you know, as we know, Oakland is limited in its resources, so they don't want to waste resources on a situation that, you know, could potentially put an innocent person in an uncomfortable or dangerous situation.
Now, Nextdoor.com responded to your report. They also spoke to us. The company's co-founder and CEO, Nirav Tolia, posted an article about it last week on the company's blog. Tolia told us that Nextdoor gets about 11 million posts every day, and racial profiling posts are probably less than 0.25% of them.
It's tiny, but again, I want to make this point that even one message about racial profiling is something that troubles us. I mean, we're taking this very seriously. We care very deeply about this. I'm a person of color myself, and so this is an issue that hits really close to my heart.
That's Nextdoor CEO Nirav Tolia. Now, if his estimate is correct, Sam, those posts could target enough people to fill Oracle Arena nearly 1.5 times every day. It's a small percentage, but it is a lot of people. What do you make of the company's response, Sam?
Well, the company has said all along, since I started reporting a story and even before that, that they do take concerns about racial profiling seriously, and I do believe that. And, you know, they've been working on different efforts internally, and I think the kind of media coverage around this issue has certainly amplified that discussion for them or maybe accelerated it a bit. But, yeah, I mean, they're definitely looking at kind of serious steps they can take, whether it's, you know, instituting new training guidelines for their own staff who are responsible for kind of responding to these conflicts, as well as to the neighborhood moderators like leads like Hugh, and you know, looking at ways that you can train them or encourage them to look at this discussion differently. And then there are folks who argue that there are ways that, you know, Nextdoor could kind of actively integrate different rules into the site that really discourage people from posting things that might be considered profiling and also weed out, you know, these kind of biased posts. And so I do think that there are ways that they could potentially aggressively and proactively respond to this issue. And it seems like they, you know, are taking those suggestions very seriously.
Sam Levin is senior writer for the East Bay Express. Sam, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's dive in on the phones now. 866-733-6786, beginning with Belinda in Oakland. Belinda, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, I live in the Millsmont area of Oakland, and I was calling because we get these, and I am a subscriber to the Nextdoor, and I get alerts almost on a daily basis with these racial profiling. And I have a 16-year-old who walks our dog every day in the neighborhood, and I've gotten alerts describing him, what he's wearing, and he's simply walking the dog through the neighborhood. So his father and I have taken the approach of telling him what to wear, how to wear it, not to be suspicious. And I just think that is so unnecessary, but necessary considering now they've amped up the security in the neighborhood, and I don't want something potentially to happen to him based on people perceiving him as a threat.
So you basically put him on notice that he has to do what he can to make himself seem a little more, just to blend in with the background and not stand out too much.
Exactly. And he's an athlete, and he likes to jog in the neighborhood. And simply by him jogging with a hood on his head, we've gotten alerts that suspicious young black boy running through the neighborhood. And that could potentially be a threat towards him if it's perceived the wrong way.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. Belinda, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much for calling in. Professor Mendoza-Denton, I saw you shaking your head as Belinda was telling her story.
Yeah, it's just it's sad, and because as we say, you know, 0.25%, but the ramifications for, you know, the mental health and you know, peace of heart of individuals who are targeted in these posts is very clear. We've heard it from Audrey, we've heard it from Belinda, and it's just it's the very antithesis of being neighborly. When in fact people are so threatened by this activity that they can't live in their neighborhoods in peace. And that was in if you read Sam Levin's original article that brought this to light, you see that over and over, that that people's lives are affected by the insensitivity of these posts. And so you have, on the one hand, these narratives about, oh my God, there's so much threat and the crime in the neighborhood, and yet the damage that's being inflicted in the neighborhood is incalculable.
Hugh Bartlett, let me turn to you a little bit in terms of hearing Belinda's story. I'm sure we all have compassion for these kind of situations. I wonder if this has prompted any, for lack of a better term, soul-searching on your part to see if this whole controversy has revealed things to you about the way you view race or your neighbors that maybe you had never grappled with before.
Oh, it has, and I think it's a constructive conversation. It's been quite lengthy in our neighborhood. We had, after the East Bay Express article, 4 or 5 threads, conversations about the article. One has gone over 100 replies. So it's quite extensive. I take exception to Belinda's characterization, not of her neighborhood, but as it might apply to mine, because I looked through the crime and safety posts for October, and there hasn't been any reports of suspicious activity.
Right.
And through September, there was one that did have some racial profiling in it, but that was one out of the whole month. It's not on a daily basis.
Audrey, I understand that you learned recently, and then we'll keep going on the phones. By the way, please feel free to keep chiming in on the phones and via email, sowellspoken@kqed.org, with your stories of dealing with race and social media. Audrey, I understand you learned recently that the area where you live was one of many in the country where blacks were systematically denied home loans. It's called redlining. And I can imagine some people hearing this story and thinking, yeah, it's real sad that people look at you funny and post it online, but at least it's not as bad as it was. At least you are actually allowed to live here. So that's progress. What do you make of that?
I would love to tie this in to something that the professor said earlier, which is that this is, historically speaking, nothing new. Ever since blacks have been in America, we have had to tell these stories to our children how to survive. And it changes decade to decade. Unfortunately, during slavery and segregation, it looked very different. Yes, it was much worse. But today, I believe that what we're hearing from people like Belinda is today's current survival story, that black parents have to teach their black children how to look unthreatening, how to be perceived as a non-threatening youth of color in our Oakland neighborhoods, and it is sad, but it's just where we're at. As Black Americans continue to move up the social ladder, the class ladder, every new rung of class that we are able to penetrate, we need to do an education on integration. And that's what I think is at the root of all this. How can we work towards educating on proper integration?
We're going to have, we actually have a guest coming up in the next segment who will speak to that, somebody out of the North Bay. By the way, we got plenty of great calls on the line. We're looking for more people from San Francisco, South Bay, North Bay. Please feel free. This is not merely an Oakland, East Bay issue. We welcome stories from all across the Bay Area, including from Stephen in Oakland. Stephen, welcome.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Well, I have been living in Oakland for over 20 years. I have a transracial family. I have felt very comfortable in Oakland. And I joined next door, the neighbors next door, and I immediately felt offended by the racial comments. And it's made me alienated from my new neighbors coming in. It feels like they don't trust our neighborhood. They don't trust our neighbors. And it's made me not interested in the line.
Stephen, would you? Oh, go ahead, Stephen.
I thought it was going to be about people having too many plums and sharing plums, but it's instead about watching, you know, brown people walking around our neighborhood.
Stephen, if you wouldn't mind, how do you describe your race or ethnicity and that of your family, just so we can get a better idea of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm white, and my children are African American, and we have loved our neighbors. We've moved in. There was people living there for 50 years. We became part of the neighborhood. And as the influx of white people move in, those people are more and more isolated and alienated and accused and watched, and it is offensive.
Have you done anything, or has anything helped in terms of bridging this gap, or has everything kind of fallen flat?
You know, I know my neighbors, so I continue to relate on a human level with my neighbors, but I don't do this online thing. I was really happy to hear this conversation because I had felt so offended and angry about this for so long.
Wow. Yeah, Stephen, I really appreciate your call. Thanks very much for calling in. Professor Mendoza-Denton, you want to jump in?
I just wanted to react to the caller's point about knowing his neighbors and the fact that next door somehow has created in some ways an opposite effect. And I think this relates a little bit to the depersonalization that we're talking about, where it's not only about the names and about the accountability, because and that is an incredibly positive step, because when things become anonymous, that, you know, really sort of opens the floodgates. But it really is about this idea of being able to understand and that there is a life and a complex person behind even a name or a particular post. And that's something that I think needs to happen when you have these online forums, these digital ways of breaking the fence. It has to be complemented by neighborhood get-togethers, by face-to-face encounters, so that people can know each other, so that people can know, you know, that young Black boy who is walking his dog, I know that boy, I know that dog, I know that family, and it doesn't become simply another member of a category. Alternatively, when someone is posting online about a particular topic, it really becomes easy to flame. And we all know that term. And flaming happens in contexts where you're one step removed from a particular person, even when that person has a name.
And nothing good ever comes of it.
Well, you know, sometimes fruitful discussions do come out of it. Well, but the
point
is
that good comes of it.
The point is that people do take liberties in online contexts that they don't in face-to-face conversations.
Let's keep going on the phones with Brian in Emeryville. Brian, welcome.
Hello. This is all very disconcerting, but alas, very believable. I think the problem here specifically is with Nextdoor. And I'm speaking from experience. Nextdoor, if you read the guidelines, sounds pretty good. However, the breakdown is in the monitors that Nextdoor allows. They don't monitor the monitors. So, for instance, in Emeryville, the monitor for Nextdoor engages in, you know, just nefarious breaking of the guidelines, rules, you know, that come from the corporate headquarters at Nextdoor. And, you know, censorship and kicking people off. not with regard to race that I've seen, but with regard to, you know, different political views that the moderator disagrees with.
Brian, do you get the sense that if Nextdoor, that if there were comments about race in your neighborhood of Emeryville, that Nextdoor might take them more seriously, maybe, than some of the comments that you've seen so far? Is it like they're policing certain things more than others?
Well, with this, specifically with the moderator for Nextdoor Emeryville, I would think that if the moderator happened to be racist, which I don't think is the case, but seeing how the moderator has dealt with politics, political issues that in this case she didn't like, she engaged in censorship. So if that person could do likewise with race. So in other words, I can see how this would propagate throughout Nextdoor. They're doing Nextdoor corporate is doing a bad job of moderating the moderators.
Right. Brian, actually, thanks for calling in, Brian. Hugh, did you want to respond to that?
Sure. Well, there's something like 75,000 neighborhoods in the country now on Nextdoor, and there's about 100 people who are employed over at Nextdoor, so there's a numbers problem there. Nextdoor realizes it, and that there's a greater problem, I think, with neighborhoods that don't have any moderator or any active moderation going on. And Nextdoor realizes that's a problem, and one of the solutions they're working on is when somebody does a crime and safety post, to have something about racial profiling come pop up.
Automatically.
Automatically, right, so that it'd be automatically moderated, which would help in the neighborhoods where there aren't active moderators. I think that Brian's moderator might be doing something that I was doing, which was there's a guideline that says to discuss community issues but avoid campaigning. So a lot of these things, and one of the posts I removed by Neighbors for Racial Justice, I interpreted as campaigning. So and since then, I've been advised that that's okay, that wasn't exactly what was meant by campaigning.
So you've had a bit of a learning curve too.
Sure. No, being a moderator is there's no school other than the school of hard knocks.
I hear that. Well, we'll keep schooling ourselves on the way to deal with race and social media in just a moment. We'll keep taking your calls. Please feel free to keep calling in. Also, we'll meet a man in the North Bay who is using social media to fight racism and white privilege online and off. Stay close. You're listening to So Well Spoken from KQED News. Back again with So Well Spoken. Audrey Esquivel, you wanted to say a word about Neighbors for Racial Justice and some of the things that your organization would suggest to try to mitigate these situations, to make things a little bit easier.
Yes, thank you, Joshua. So one of the things that we're doing is we're working to help create, you know, the idea of effective crime reporting, what that looks like, defining that. But also wanted to mention that in terms of these moderators, we understand that these are volunteers who are working outside of their day jobs to do this. But we're wondering if it's not possible for Nextdoor and for the Yahoo groups and the other neighborhood email listservs to provide some base level of social justice or unconscious bias training so that as you go forward in moderation, that you're better equipped to handle these types of emails. So I would love to throw that out there for consideration.
Professor Mendoza-Denton?
I think that that's a really wonderful idea. I mean, volunteers are doing a lot of work. And at the same time that people may have concerns that, well, you know, then it doesn't become sort of the organic, neighborly sort of online presence that it was meant to be. And yet when it takes on that that level of reach, there is a responsibility, I think, to be able to train people, not just in unconscious bias, but in specific rules and sets of guidelines, because then it makes really concrete what is possible and what is not possible.
Let's keep talking about solutions now with a white man who is using this technology to show support for people of color. Christopher Bowers is the co-founder of Racial Justice Allies, Racial Justice Allies of Sonoma County, a group focused on giving whites a space to confront racism and support equality. Christopher, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, one of the major issues that I understand you tackle in your group is white privilege. That's the concept that whites enjoy social perks today through really no fault or effort of their own, but including insulation from subtle acts of racism as a legacy of more strict systems of racism. And I understand that some of these conversations have gotten so heated that they've cost you friends. How do we talk these things out in ways that don't just pull us apart? What's worked for you?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think something I'm still learning. I mean, I think the guests have brought up this aspect of anonymity and even used a metaphor that I've thought about around two people being in a car and just sort of flipping each other off. And often online, when I have these conversations online, I feel like that's what it gets to, that whether it's because you can't see somebody's actual facial express the tone in their voice, it can go poorly very, very quickly. And so increasingly over the years that I've been involved with this kind of stuff, I feel like keeping things exclusively online and these conversations exclusively online is ultimately not not useful, that there at least has to be some follow-up in person. And it's been frustrating for me because some of the times that people have been most reactive or vitriolic, I've really tried to invite them into a larger conversation and be a part of the community that's talking about this by coming to a dialogue or even just meeting me for coffee. And the vast majority of the time, in fact, I think almost every time, that offer, that invitation has not been taken up.
Well, Christopher, I have to admit, I mean, I'm a black man, so I don't know what white people talk about when they talk about white privilege and black folk aren't there. I can only imagine what that conversation sounds like. And it feels like just an inherently uncomfortable conversation to have in person. But online, it's just so easy to go block, unfollow, delete, click, and you go away. And the whole problem just goes away.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that has happened, and that's exactly why, I mean, I do try to, and I think that's actually part of the problem, too, is that it is tempting. You know, for myself, I've been tempted to unfriend that person or write them off or whatever, but by doing that, I think that perpetuates the problem that you know, where we become very divided and lose opportunities to create solidarity and to... I mean, we have to be allies to each other as white people in being able to be allies to people of color, because we need support in our own communities as well, in that sense, community being a community of white people who care about racism.
Since you've been dealing with this issue very directly, if there is someone who is listening, who is white, who wants to engage on this but doesn't really know what to do, is sure that no matter what they're going to say, it's going to get really, really ugly. What advice would you have for them if they're listening for one thing they could do next time this subject comes up or they feel the need to bring it up? What could they do?
If they're afraid of someone being reactive and defensive, you could try a stance of curiosity. And I guess the first thing I would say is, even if it doesn't go as you would hope, the fact, I don't think that should be a reason not to say something. It's easy to let that be a reason to kind of drop out of the conversation. But I'd rather see someone do it clumsily or even in a way that's maybe not the most skillful than not do it at all. But one thing is to take a curious stance and just be curious about someone's ideas and their position and have that be a way to open the conversation. I don't think it's useful to just say you're being racist and put a label on it and an identity on it. It may be true. It may be there may be truth in it, but it's not necessarily going to advance the conversation or advance the cause any.
Right. Christopher Bowers is the co-founder of Racial Justice Allies of Sonoma County. Christopher, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me get to some of our online comments. Karen emailed, "Your guests appear to be using the term racial profiling interchangeably with racial identification. In other words, they seem to be saying that the mere identification of a person's color in a communication is profiling. How else would someone describe a person?" Audrey, I see you shaking your head.
No, that's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that if the entirety of the email only says there is a brown-skinned woman walking slowly by my house, be on the lookout for suspicious behavior, that's me walking home. That's racial profiling. There's nothing that describes anything suspicious. There's nothing wrong with a human walking by your house. But because you have a fear-based bias against brown or black skin, it therefore becomes profiling.
Bruce emailed us, I have been an Oakland resident for over 15 years. I am willing to give anyone the benefit of the doubt, but after being held up by two young black men with a gun, I'm a little more leery of individuals that look similar. They told my friend and me to get on the ground, give up our stuff, and then patted us down. It is upsetting to me that this is the same modus operandi and description that you hear over and over in Oaktown, and it certainly isn't fair to the young men who are not participating in crime. We've also gotten some interesting comments on Twitter. Cam B. tweeted us, when I get the urge to racially profile black people, I remind myself that white people are the greatest threat to public safety. And we also got a tweet from someone with the best Twitter handle I have ever heard, at Ornery Piglet. Ornery Piglet. I love it. God bless you, Ornery Piglet. Ornery Piglet wrote to us on Twitter, I gave up on my blocks next door. I got tired of telling new folks that kid lives here and isn't suspicious. And please stop announcing every black person sighting. These are our neighbors. Let's continue on the phones now with Eric in Oakland. Eric, welcome.
Yeah, I have to say that one of your guests made a comment about asking yourself whether you would feel the same way if the person you see is of a different race would make you have the same reaction. And I find that I've been using that screen on my own reactions more and more. On the other hand, I wanted to provide some context that the neighborhoods involved in a lot of this have experienced what they perceive as being a rash of burglaries, robberies, break-ins over the last 5 or 6 years that have been exacerbated by, well, let me say that for a while, the Oakland police had one patrol car for the entire Oakland Hills.
Right. We know that they're severely understaffed. Yeah, yeah.
So the result has been that, you know, the fear in these neighborhoods is real, and it's not less real for being sometimes misdirected. And both things are both statements are correct, and it's a conundrum. I don't know how to resolve it, but there it is.
Well, Eric, let's see if we can. Thanks for calling in, Eric. Let's see if we can resolve that. Anybody have any thoughts on what Eric said? This need to not profile balanced with the fact that OPD has been dramatically understaffed, and that a number of neighborhoods just feel like there's no way that the police can really cover them. Hugh,
well, certainly neighborhood watch is a function of next door. And it is true that the neighbors have to look out for each other. And I do think that Nextdoor is a good platform for that. If enough people are participating, they get to know one another and get to know who belongs in the neighborhood, what the faces look like. And it's going to make it a safer place for everybody in the neighborhood.
Let's continue on the phones now with Cedric in Oakland. Cedric, welcome.
Thank you.
What's on your mind, Cedric?
Yes, I want to talk about something I actually saw today next door, where someone posted a poster that was on a light pole or somewhere in one of the neighborhoods, where they mentioned there was a black guy who approached them with a pit bull and asked for his or her number and if they can exchange numbers and be friends. And she kind of, or he, I don't know if it was he or she, felt that they were trying to rob them. And so that, to me, just kind of, it didn't really give any criminal information. It just gave a black man with a pit bull who asked for your number. It kind of sounded like someone that was trying to perhaps hit on you versus someone that was trying to rob you. But those are the kinds of things that I've experienced on Nextdoor, to where it's not racially identifying. It's bluntly racially profiling, because that black guy could be me, you know, trying to actually meet a friend.
Right, right. Cedric, let me put that point. Thanks for calling in with that, Cedric. Professor Mendoza-Denton, I see you shaking your head and kind of agreeing with Cedric.
I go back to the tweet or the email you read about someone who said they're using racial profiling interchangeably with racial identification. But I think that those two ideas have to be separated very clearly. And Cedric's example is one very clear example. When you begin with saying there's this black guy with a pit bull, right? That's an identification, of course, but it's profiling because it puts the category membership of the individual first. So again, if we go back to the recommendations of Neighbors for Racial Justice of specific behaviors, you get around a lot of those issues. I would imagine that if someone came up to me and randomly asked me for my phone number, I would be uncomfortable no matter the situation. And maybe that's postable. But then to immediately tag it or to have the first identification be of racial category membership, it's identification, but it's also profiling. And I think that needs to be very clear.
I wonder if there might also be a generational divide at play here. We had a next door member in Oakland call our voicemail line this morning to tell us that a number of these problematic posts are coming from senior citizens, and he suspects that seniors might not engage with race in or might engage with race in light of the generation that they came from. And as mores have changed, as time has changed, that people of different generations engage with issues of race differently. Is there something to that? Hugh Bartlett, do you see any truth to that in the post you deal with?
Difficult to respond to. I really can't say.
Audrey?
I think in terms of coming out of our houses and interacting face to face, I know at least once a year we do the block parties. I could see that maybe an elderly person would not be coming out of their house more often and might not have the opportunity to meet people face to face in that way. So I could see that. I really wanted to respond to the previous caller if I could.
Please.
So I just want to be absolutely transparent, and I do not think we can ignore the actual crime statistics of Oakland. And we have to talk absolutely who is actually committing the crimes, right? And yes, these people might look like some of your neighbors on the outside physically. But I think to respond again to one of the comments that was received in response to the East Bay Express article that said, oh, this is the plight of unthreatening blacks trying to live peacefully in an affluent Oakland neighborhood. The reality is you can't look at a person of color and tell, you know, who has ill intent and who does not. So understanding, first of all, that this area, these are not all white neighborhoods. You have neighbors that are people of color. And regardless of the crime statistics, we all have to come out and meet each other face to face so you know who is living in your neighborhood.
Professor Mendoza-Denton.
And you were mentioning about solutions, solutions for, you know, that communities can work to together. A great solution might be organizing to appropriate funds, whether that be parcel measures to for funding for the police department. That's something that everyone can get on board with. I'm not sure about the effectiveness of the profiling online.
Yeah, and I don't. I wish I knew whether or not communities have tried to do that in Oakland. I know communities elsewhere in other parts of the country have done that and very successfully raised property tax dollars for exactly that. Well, we've been clearly taking this deeper look at how social media affects our dialogue on race, as well as our national dialogue, including the rise of the movement Black Lives Matter. You can explore our coverage on that and hear previous shows online at kqed.org/sowellspoken. Also, before we run out of time for this hour, I want to make sure you know about next week's show. We'd like to hear from you. Next week, we'll focus on the physical spaces we share. We're going to take it offline and go out into the real world and talk about places where people of all races and all cultures interact and places where we don't. So I want to hear from you. Where in the Bay Area, where do you find lots of racial diversity or lots of sameness? Email us your stories, your insights. The address is sowellspoken@kqed.org. Also, feel free to leave us a voicemail, 415-553-8455. Again, that's 415-553-8455. Where in the Bay Area do you find lots of racial diversity or lots of sameness? You can also tweet your stories and insights with the hashtag KQED Spoken. I wonder if we can squeeze in one more phone call from Paul in San Francisco. Paul, welcome.
Hi, I'm a private investigator in San Francisco. I've been doing this for 40, 50 years. Anytime there's an accident, when people are describing the accident, what's the first word out of their mouth that they're describing used to describe the accident? And this study was done amongst animals also. I mean, animals see in color. And that's why red is such an important color for animals and humans. When you see an accident, the first word out of most people's mouth is, oh, it was a green car and a blue car collided at the corner of 24th and Mission. They don't say the model of the car, the year. They say the color. And these politically correct people who say, don't use the color when you're describing a 6-foot black guy who's got a pit bull, and he comes up and he's demanding your phone number, that's wrong humanly.
Hey, Paul, I hate to cut you short. We're almost out of time for the hour. I'm really sorry to cut you short, but I want to give the panel a chance to respond to that, this notion that we tend to see things in color. Hugh Bartlett, what do you make of his comment? Briefly, well, please.
I'm not an expert on racial profiling, so I'd like to defer my my time to Rudy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's often the assumption that race is an automatic perceived quality, but that's not the case across the world. So I disagree, period.
Audrey?
I think that he's hitting on something that's absolutely relevant to this conversation, and that there is a significant chunk of the population that would agree with our caller. And as a result, we absolutely need to do education around pulling out these types of biases that tie into fear based on skin color. He's proven our point.
I have to say that as we wrap up this hour, I really appreciate you all coming in and being good neighbors to one another. I appreciate it, and I think it helped drive the dialogue forward. Audrey Esquivel of Oakland, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Hugh Bartlett of Oakland, thanks for being with us. Glad to have had you here.
Thank you.
And UC Berkeley Professor Rodolfo Mendoza-Denton, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So Well Spoken is produced by Vinnie Tong. Our director is Susie Racho. Danny Bringer is our audio engineer. Our editorial team includes Sundia Dirks, Devin Katayama, Irene Noguchi, Latoya Tools, and Adiza Egan. We get online support from David Weir, Olivia Allen Price, David Marks, and Lisa Pickoff-White. Bryce Eberhardt and Joanne Martinez helped spread the word. The senior editor of KQED News is Julia McAvoy. Our executive editor is Holly Kernan. Keep the conversation going right now on Twitter with the hashtag KQEDSpoken. So Well Spoken comes to you from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. And please, speak up.